of the customers don't usually have transmitters. That's the least of these manufacturers' problems.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul?
Yeah, I believe a Faraday cage does not have to really be grounded, you know, unless you're worried about, you know, high voltage, you know, getting a shock or something. But, you know, to stop RF, you really don't have to ground it.
Well, yeah, but it's always kind of nice to have a ground tap so that anything that that might just kind of simmer on the outside doesn't kind of leak around the edges. Okay, unfortunately, I couldn't make out that call sign. You want to try again?
Apologies, Roy. AC2PO.
Oh, yeah, Jeff.
Yeah, I think it's probably a good point for us to review what the FCC came out with in, I think it was 2021, where we need to do RF surveys for all of our radiators and all of our radios with their intended purposes, meaning the power that we intended to radiate.
Yeah, I think the primary concern was human exposure to radio waves, because I think part of the assessment depended upon the location of human beings as opposed to washing machines. But yeah, the FCC did make that pronouncement. We had a electrical engineer who put together a Excel sheet, I think, and we put it on the webpage of my other club, the Kings County Radio Club, that if you wanted to use his. The ARRL has since then has issued their own spreadsheet where you can insert numbers and get values back. But that's very important. But I think primarily the FCC was more interested in people being exposed to excessive amounts of RF rather than washing machines and garage door openers.
Yeah, Roger. If there's another person in the controlled or the uncontrolled environment, then they're getting exposed to RF. That's an absolute fact. And, you know, that's the purpose of their missive or whatever it is that we had all somehow magically avoided up to that point. I think that if you're actually feeding enough RF back into your home that you're affecting lights and control devices, then you are, at least in your controlled environment, you definitely have RF. And in the uncontrolled environment, it's, I think, the permissible levels are even lower. So if there's an apartment next door, for example.
Yeah. Well, I mean, unfortunately, I think people are more concerned with the nuisance of their electrical equipment malfunctioning rather than something happening to them. But, I mean, that goes along with the unbridled fear of non-technical people that cell phones are cooking our heads. You know, I always like to include the little side note that there has been no experimental evidence for serious ailments due to RF other than contact burns. At the energy level that we use as transmitters, it produces local heat. Local heat isn't helpful in some cases, but if you walk out of into a sunny day, you're exposed to some significant amounts of heat as well. So fortunately, you know, other than electrical shocks and heat damage from sparking and such, local exposure to RFs are probably more of a concern to people because their beloved electrical equipment is malfunctioning, or God forbid, their computer is rebooting itself repeatedly.
Yeah, Roger. Of course, I agree. And there was I think there was a broad study done of British police officers using UHF radios, and there was no conclusive evidence that there was any of them transmitting on those devices. What I'm talking about is the possible inconvenience of getting FCC coming by and raiding our sci-fi. It's as unlikely as that is adherence to certain standards, I think, is at least we should know about it.
Yeah, I agree. It is a good thing that they issued that requirement. And I'm curious how many people have a copy of their results located in their shack like they're supposed to. But unfortunately, I don't know exactly what the budget for the FCC is these days, but I can only assume that their budget will be even less as time progresses.
Yeah, probably zero.
Easy.
Bill, back to that.
Okay, you two doubled.
This is W2BC. Let me see if I have it. Yes, I do. If you have a 10 to 1 SWR and you lower it to... are you receiving better signals or is your receiver working better from like a 10 to 1 to a 1.5 to 1?
Well, theoretically, yes. What you're effectively doing is you are transforming your input impedance level. So the closer your impedance levels are to a nominal 50 ohms, the more efficient your transfer and the stronger amplitude your signal. And you can prove that to yourself. You can just go on any part of the band. It doesn't even need to have any one signal, but just static. And as you adjust your antenna tuner close to the resonant point, you should be hearing more noise than when it was off resonance or in off impedance transform correction. So, yeah, it's better to have a 50-ohm impedance antenna input to your receiver. You get more energy transfer and more signal power going into your receiver circuits.
Okay. Well, I think you answered everything, and everybody, thank you very much for your input. So I'll turn it over back to you, Roy. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu, clear.
Okay, very good, Rich. Thank you, as always, for your participation. Brian, you wanted to say something?
Yes, just one question. Is an aluminum foil, a possibility to use as a Faraday cage, or do you need something like a steel or something of that magnitude?
It will suffice. It doesn't quite have the oomph. You in a perfect world, it's best to have some kind of alloy that has a high mu value so that it has a better interaction with electromagnetic waves. But in a pinch, if you're stuck, aluminum foil will work to a degree. You might want to double and triple and quadruple up so at least the thickness is a little bit deeper because, again, these things are not binary zeros and ones. These offer a degree of attenuation. The thicker they are, the more they attenuate.
So what was the value that you used? You mentioned a specific value term.
Yeah, they're called high mu values for metal alloys. You just just Google in high mu.
Okay, and what would be a reasonable example of that, like that's bendable and usable then?
I don't know. I believe there are some steel alloys that have particular additives in the alloy that improve its ability to block RF.
Okay, so the higher the U, the better.
Yeah, within reason. I mean, you're not the Jet Propulsion Lab.
Understood. Thank you very much, Roy. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Wes, you know, it's 9:12. It's up to you. Do you mind if I take a few of the people farther down? Because usually questions don't take that much time.
No problem at all. Dr. Wayne, and take shit.
Okay, John, WA2VDH, you had a question or a comment about television?
WA2VDH. Yeah, I have, a question, well, more of a comment, actually. I have a Sharp 43-inch, allegedly LED TV. It's about 5 years old. Backlights on it, backlights that illuminate the back of the screen so that the LCD panel can display its picture. One of the LEDs went out, and so I decided to, just for the heck of it, to learn more about it, I decided to repair it. First of all, the idea that they call these TVs LED TVs is very misleading. It's advertised as an LED TV. The screen is liquid crystal display. It is an LCD screen. However, they call it an LED TV because rather than use those compact fluorescent tubes to illuminate the backlighting so you can project light through the screen and see the picture, they use white LEDs to do the backlight illumination, which makes the picture visible. And as such, they call it an LED TV. So it seems a lot of these older TVs from a couple of years ago that are advertised as LED TVs are in fact LCD screens, just using LED backlights. So that's one comment. Let me drop. So I opened up the TV. It's very interesting how flimsy these things are constructed. It breaks down to really about two or three circuit boards that they just seem to paste anywhere. There's the main board, and there's a switching power supply board, which supplies power to the LEDs and the main board. And then there's these strange-looking ribbon cables that come off there that turns the video signal into an array, sort of an XY array, so that they can address each of the pixels in the screen, turning it on or off with its associated red, green, or blue transistor there, so that it can either block or pass light from the backlights to illuminate the little pixel. And there's quite a lot of these flat ribbon cables that have, it must have about 70, 80, 90, maybe more conductors in them. So it's very interesting. It's quite interesting the way they slap these things together. But anyway, the problem with it is really that one of the LEDs in that backlight arrangement, one of those LEDs opened up, and then as soon as the power supply doesn't see the right amount of impedance for the LED series stream. Let me drop. As soon as the switching power supply doesn't see the right impedance for the backlight, it shuts down, and the rest of the TV is still working. You just can't see the picture because there's nothing illuminating it from the back to make the various little pixels pass or block the light so you can see the screen. But everything else in the works, so it's just interesting how these things are slapped together. I'm getting some more of these little white LEDs. They're all surface mount, but you could buy a whole strip of them, and I'll just replace the whole strip and put the thing back together. So I just wanted to make that comment that lots of TVs that are advertised as LED TVs are in fact LCD with just LED white backlights to provide the backlighting for the LCD screen. So I just wanted to make that comment back to Ned.
AC2GS, well, thank you, John. I'll talk a little bit about that. It's more of a historical and marketing reason that it is that they're trying to steal from anyone or cheat anyone or con anyone. Historically, in the olden days, initially liquid crystal display panels had color filters in the front, had liquid crystal display membranes that when you put a voltage potential, you change the polarization angle, and you had another polarizer that interacted with it, and, you know, if they were 90 degrees out of phase with each other, they would block all the light, and if they were zero degrees phase, they would transfer the light. And then there was the question of, well, what are you going to do, how are you going to light it? And in the very old days of the beginning of liquid crystal displays, active liquid crystal displays that had little transistors inside of each of the pixels, they used cold fluorescent lights, CFLs. And I once took apart a Lenovo laptop and swapped out the fluorescent bulb with a new bulb to kind of bring it back to life, because that was the best that you could probably offer. And so, you know, they were liquid crystal displays, but they were with fluorescent lights in the background that had all the joys that fluorescent light gives you. The slightly annoying green color cast, the occasional flickering and what have you. The breakthrough was to put the LEDs in the background instead of fluorescence, and so they marketed it as an LED TV, not that it was no longer liquid crystal display, but the illuminating back was LED, which was the best that money could get you, because no one had the faintest idea how to do organic light-emitting diodes or micro-LEDs that are actual pixels. Even now, unless you buy a massive panel, they can't cram the micro-LEDs in a small enough space to light up a 42-inch television. So, you know, it wasn't anything that they meant to do. It's just, it was a big step forward technologically. People preferred having a backlit LEDs than fluorescents. Then they had regionally addressable LEDs, so you can blacken out portions of the background and improve the dynamic range, because if you had a picture of a half-dark picture and light would bleed through the dark end unless you could address it and turn it off. So that became addressable LED backgrounds, and now we're talking about micro-LEDs and such. And, of course, somewhere along the line, they took away the old-fashioned light filters for quantum dots. So that gives you the quantum LED and the quantum LCD marketing ploys. But, it's been advancing. I do not think I have seen an LED backlit LCD TV described as an LED TV in maybe about 8 years. Again, it was kind of reasonable marketing at that time.
Quick question.
Yes, Brian?
I'm sorry. Who is the gentleman, I didn't get your call, who had the ability to repair that LED on that burnt out one?
Oh, yeah, my call is WA2 Victor David Henry, WA2 VDH.
Sorry, what's your first name, please?
John.
Hi, John. This is Brian, KF2CC. I'm curious, how did you go about replacing that LED? And what I mean by that is, like, how did you get the correct part and value? Was there a schematic you downloaded?
Well, I did get the manual for the TV. I didn't find that particularly useful. The main information is just the original TV, the TV model number, and also are actually on the various components. Like all of the boards have a part number, the TV model number, and then when you're looking up at these various places online, they match up the LED strips by you know, model of the TV, so that you know what strips you're buying. Now you can buy like a strip of the LEDs, but if you really want to get good at it, and I've seen one or two people do it online, you can replace the individual LEDs, their surface mount. So you need a hot air source, you know, to strip off the old one and surface mount the new LED little chip right on it. You can do that. I don't have any surface mount of LEDs. Okay.
Yes, John, I appreciate that. And just curiously, how much like would a strip cost versus buying a new television? A substantial difference?
Oh, it is definitely. I mean, if you have a TV that has this problem, personally, it's economically, you better off just buying another television. They're so darn cheap. I mean, I think it's what $175 or something. I've already spent about $70 or $80 or $90 just getting the manual and some other stuff. So I mean, economically, it's just get another TV. But I was sort of curious about it, and I also want to fix this TV because it does have the standard NTSC video inputs and S video inputs that I need for my DVD recorder, which is a whole other story. Anyway. So I all of the newer TVs only have HDMI, which has some interesting little protections built into it.
Okay, got it. Thank you very much, John. Appreciate it. Back to Roy.
Okay, very good. Yeah, HDMI has a lot of copy protection. I would imagine, though, there's some place that sells a breakout box that takes an HDMI that's not encrypted and can split it into composites and such, but I haven't looked for it in years. Yeah, for you it's a labor of love. Present-day electrical technicians don't really repair things like TV sets anymore. I had my flat panel die on me in warranty, and it was very nice. They came in, they screwed out the back, they popped out a PC board that had to be 2 square feet, popped in a new one, screwed everything down, turned it on, it worked, and they left. And I'm sure that entire board is not going to be recycled for anything particularly useful. We are in the disposable era of electronics as well as many other things.
Yes, this is absolutely true. Everything is designed to be throwaway. I remember when telephones were made by Western Electric, you could toss them out from the 20th floor, they'd hit the street and still be working fine. Of course now, because the consumer pays for the phone, they're anyway, back to Ned.
Yeah, that was a great racket. You couldn't buy the phone, you could only rent the phone. So you could have the same damn phone for 40 years, and if you add up the price that you paid for the damn phone, you could have bought about 5 or 6 phones.
Yeah. A lot of stories goes along with that. I remember from fond days with telephony, but again, another story.
Yeah, there's planned obsolescence. I think Wesley is going to kind of talk partially on it because he sent me an email with, the old-fashioned light bulbs. There's one that's been working for 100-plus years, except, of course, that it takes very low power and produces very low illumination. And, you know, if I swapped out your house lights for similar bulbs, you throw them in the garbage the next day. Because, you know, think of your house lit up by something like 1 or 2 watt light bulbs.
Actually, you know, I have, I think I have still a few left, 130-volt bulbs. I haven't seen any on the market lately, but I remember several years ago, this is going back maybe 15 years or so, I bought a couple of bulbs that were 130 volts, and on 120 volts, they very slightly aren't very slightly yellow. You can see they're definitely a little dimmer, but they lasted. I must have gotten out of one of them. I think I must have gotten something like 12,000-13,000 hours compared to the other bulbs. And I think I still have one of them around here somewhere. That's still going strong. So. That's another thing. Some of these incandescent bulbs like that, they're designed to fail, as you say. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's the nature of things. I mean, now, theoretically, 10, 15, 20 years ago, we were told that they weren't going to allow selling incandescent light bulbs. You can still, thankfully, get them because I use them for my oven because you can't really put an LED bulb into an oven and turn it on anymore. So fortunately, there is still a place for incandescents, although they burn out rather quickly. And I remember the promise of LEDs when they were kind of taking over from fluorescent replacements, that they would last a lifetime. Unfortunately, though, LEDs are very sensitive to temperature. If you put them in an enclosed area and then the heat kind of bakes them, or even if you put them in a strange position, orientation can limit the lifespan of an LED bulb. So I've had LED bulbs go out on me as well. You know, nothing lasts forever anymore.
Yeah, I have a few LED bulbs. I think I have one as a backyard light there, and it's lasted pretty long. But as you say, nothing lasts forever.
Yes, indeed. Oh, well, who knows? Maybe they'll invent something even better than LEDs in the future. You never quite know. I mean, LEDs are a great story in and of themselves. The discovery of the blue LED, which took decades, and the poor guy made a pittance in the research lab, and he was doing it practically on his own time because Nitschia was tired of him failing. And then LEDs, a lot of LEDs these days are UV LEDs with fluorescence coatings that change their color output to that cool white light versus warm white light. So, you know, we could make a night just talking about LED bulb technologies and incandescent light bulbs. Technologies. I'm sure there are people out there who still think that Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. He improved it. He didn't invent it.
Yes, a lot of interesting things in history like that. One interesting point about LEDs as you look at the changes in color of the LEDs and compare it to the forward operating voltage, you could see as the LEDs go from red to orange to yellow and then into the blue and even ultraviolet, you'll see that the forward voltage goes up as it should because of the band gap energy. Higher band gap energy means a shorter wavelength of light and therefore a higher frequency of light. And there's a very interesting correspondence of looking at the forward voltage versus color of these LEDs. So a lot of the physics, as I say, becomes obvious when you look at it from that point of view.
It's conservation of energy. Obviously, you know, that voltage drop, energy has to go someplace. In the cases of early diodes, it was infrared and waste heat, but as you change the band gap and the voltage drop, you had higher and higher frequency electromagnetic waves produced, and so became the LEDs. Matter of fact, about a year or two ago, one of my TechNet puzzles was a question that I gave someone a blue LED and a red LED and painted the lens black. How can you tell the difference? And the answer is by measuring the voltage drop.
Yeah, just looking at the forward voltage drop when it's conducting, you can identify the one with the higher frequency light, that is the blue one, versus the red one.
Yes, indeed.
Well, that was my only comment about the TV. So I'll turn it back to Neff and let the next person go.
Okay, very good, John. Thank you as always for participating. A long time ago, when Dick was still alive, I did a presentation on the different technologies of display screens. Reflective screen technology that we see in e-readers today, and transmissive that we see in most televisions are transmissive technology, using either liquid crystal displays as a kind of open and closed valve for light back illuminated versus active transmission of organic light emitting diodes with color filters on them, or making LEDs that are that color. There are different ways of handling it. So thank you, John, as always. I appreciate your participation. Jeff, you wanted to make a comment about artificial intelligence?
Hey, if you could be able, if we still have time.
Yeah, we got time.
Okay, roger. Very quick comment on diodes. I do recall studying for the extra. It was a very long chapter on diodes, so there's a lot to be said there, so I appreciate the emphasis there. The comment on AI is that you did mention that there's a $200 charge for the top tier access to OpenAI, but it turns out that kind of the more general users who pay $20 a month, as I do, for access to OpenAI ChatGPT, have been given, all of these platforms are rushing to give a little bit more to their users as their competition grows. So the OpenAI users that have kind of a standard access level have been given access to the deep research, 10 sessions of deep research per month. And I was unaware of that until one of my students came and told me. There's also a button that you can click at the bottom of the page when you go to do a search. Let me drop. Where you can click on, there's either the deep research or there's a search button. And the search button effectively allows the AI to go out and search the web and use more than its training. The training for, I think, ChatGPT claims to have stopped somewhere in 2021 or 22. If you click that search button, it allows it to go and search the web and give you more recent results. But if you click on the other button in the search tool, if you're a paid user, even at the low level, you can do a deep research. And I took advantage of that recently to give it a fairly involved biochemical question. It came back with an answer after about half an hour, after asking me a couple additional queries, which was 100% accurate. Roy, I could not believe it. This is the first time I was actually pleased with the result. QSL.
Well, you know what they say, a broken clock is right at least twice a day. I've had terrible experiences with AI. I've had interesting, reasonable experiences with AI. As far as OpenAI, DeepSeek kind of scared Sam, you know, what, out of his chair. So they've been offering little additions to most of the people who are only willing to pay something like $20 a month. This new feature where it kind of takes over a web browser and can book you a dinner someplace is the latest, greatest add-on that they haven't offered, as far as I'm aware, the $20 a month people, even to kind of test out. But eventually, I'm sure something like that will happen. You know, they have to figure out how to make money. They're losing money all over the place with all these fees that they seem to be charging. There's not enough people paying these things to get the money back. So they're in a death spiral of spending money. And especially, you know, when the Chinese come by and announce that they use some scotch tape and bubble gum to put together another AI, you know, it drives them insane.
Yeah, Roger. Roger. And that's actually another point I should make is that some of the students that I have who are quite technologically advanced are using all of the AI simultaneously. Grok, DeepSeek, ChatGPT, a bunch of others. And then they're evaluating the work themselves, or they're evaluating the work against other AIs. So they're kind of on an ad hoc basis, kind of testing them out against each other. So there's a lot of really interesting kind of low-level research going on. But this was not a case, Roy, where this was a clock being right twice a day. This was a very, very specific question that I asked about one specific enzyme and how I could determine which antibodies or affinity reagents were binding to it specific over a very other closely related off target, and it came back with the exact correct answer. I couldn't believe my eyes at when it got it right, because it has gotten it wrong so many times, right?
Amen.
Brian recognized, but let me just add a couple things. Is it possible that there's a searchable article on the subject that it had access to this time that it didn't have access to the last time?
ACTPL. It's absolutely possible. The research on this particular enzyme goes back to about 2010, so it had access to information going up to 2021 according to its training. That being said, when I asked the normal GPT for particulars about that, it gave me a bunch of nonsense. And when I asked the regular search bar for, say, search the patent literature, all it wanted to do was search the abstracts, and it told me it couldn't find it. And then when I clicked it over to Deep Research, which is something which I was only recently told I had access to, it came back with a full dossier, which was all 100% accurate. It was actually impressed. And I only spend $20 a month, but it seems like it might become worth it.
Okay, well, we will see how this develops, because we are certainly not at the end. Promises have been made that I think are semi-ridiculous. I'm not really that optimistic that the general artificial intelligence promise for any day now is going to come into existence. I certainly don't think the super intellect that will be able to provide endless resources for mankind is, you know, that's a real pipe dream, if ever I saw a pipe dream. So we'll see. I think AI is legitimate. I think some of the promises that have been made are absurd. And it'll be interesting to see if there is a wall, There are computer specialists who think that there are inherent walls to generative technology, and others that think that just by adding a reasoning module, you get to the moon. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see. And millions and billions of dollars will be won and lost in this battle.
ACTPL. I 100% agree, and I was at dinner the night before, with a lawyer from Bloomberg Company and a couple other people from Bloomberg and some other family members. And they said that they had just gone to kind of a very high-level thought leader conference on that very topic. And they said it is... it's only just now been released to users of that company with a very long list of caveats as to what's allowable.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel bad, as always, for the guys who were unlucky, because it's all ultimately luck. You're betting on racehorses, and you don't know which racehorse is going to win the race and which one's going to break their leg.
ACTPL. Well, again, I don't want to order Chinese food with it. I just want to get a list of references that I can read. You know what I mean? Anyway, ACTPL, back to that. Thanks, Roy, for what you do.
Hi. You're welcome. Amazon is guessing and hoping that everyone is going to want to order their Chinese through Alexa. So, you know, we'll see how that goes for them. They made that big announcement last week that sometime this month they said they were going to start rolling it out to different devices, Echo devices. So, who knows? It's a wild west. And, just keep your head down. Brian, you wanted to say something?
Yes, just a quick comment. You know, in my opinion, honestly, you know, there is no... It isn't artificial intelligence. It's more of artificial aggregation. Go ahead and ask it, well, create me a drug that will cure this disease or that disease. Build a fusion reactor at the size of there are such limitations to this. Even when you do use an AI search, it lists all its sources where it grabbed the information from. And it's very, very helpful in some respects. But to call it intelligent, no, I'll pass on that comment.
Okay, Brian, I mean, we kind of discussed this before, that they're taking liberties with the term intelligence, and I would agree with you that people are kind of endlessly looking for an analogy for things, and my best analogy I've come up with is that it's a probability device that completes a paragraph. In other words, you know, like much dumber programs where you start a sentence and it offers you a few options based upon data it has that you've used the terms earlier in a conversation, but this is kind of on steroids right now. But we'll see how this develops. It's not going to go away next week, so we'll have lots and lots of time to discuss this. And I'm sorry, Wesley, but we'll get to you in a minute. I promise. Okay, well, Wesley, you want to do your thing?
No, why not? Thank you very much, Dr. Ray. To kilowatt antenna 5 band, 7 meter, 14 meter, 21 meter, 28 meter, 29 meter, and 50 meter. High efficiency, low noise. Let me drop. Okay, I'm going to try to speed up. Positive V works very well for DXing SSB and or any digital modes like FT8. It handles 2,000 watts PVP on single side band and up to 1,000 watts on CW. For LTD-wise mode, which is perfect for mode amplifiers, end of quote. And in the picture that I sent to the floor, it is shown that two wrenches and one Allen key are included in the package. As I assume, it was cheaper to add them than change Chinese production from FTP to Imperial. They oriented themselves now to into Europe as their main market. As the USA today becomes too expensive and is not so profitable to them, especially for the last 6 weeks. However, it is not bad to have a metric standard wrenches in your shack, helping you to disassemble this antenna if needed. With how this antenna works, if you look at the vertical delta loop antenna, it has two waves in the form of the letter V, but this antenna is not the delta loop antenna. But root of the antenna, so how to describe it, please picture to yourself two waves in the form of letter V at the angle of 70 degrees joined together with triangular plate at the bottom having a power mounted at its V-shaped bottom. Each weave has two traps for 40 and 20 meters. Few words about the balloon. Model HF5M2K balloon is the Chinese 2 kilowatt knockoff working up from 5 megahertz to 60 megahertz, which is perfect at 50 ohms of, I believe, polymer engineers. For those who want to play Chinese games, the antenna sold by Canada retailer DXCanada.ca. Again, DXCanada.ca is made by like a good quality worth to pay $499.99 of Canadian dollars. However, the balloon in the package may not be the 102 kilowatts PEP and definitely not the same model. So you may need to ask specifically for the one mentioned by me. Can you hear me? Yeah. Okay. The problem in the past may not be. This is the 102 kilowatts, and the picture posted in that I sent to Dr. Roy is about another model, which is CB5MA2K, and goes only to 30 megahertz, but as dedicated modes like the main pressure, as it was made, especially for the Chinese made steroids, and it's to ask the manufacturer this question, language problems and lack of specification of the product doesn't affect the stock. Can you hear me just a minute?
Unfortunately, there's a lot of noise in the background.
Okay. How is it coming out?
Right now it's coming out fine. But I assume once you get back to what you're talking about, there'll be a lot of noise in your background.
Yeah, I would appreciate a person who is trying to do best to not do it. and I would be very thankful for it. So the antenna is a high voltage antenna having 750 volt to 1.3 kilovolt in peak, and it has two capacitive reactive elements at right angle to each whip right after the second trap. Similar to the top capacitor of the Tesla coil, but limited in size and material due to the economic circumstances, I assume. You may call them the Chinese form of capacitive reactors. Another element of this antenna is the element that looks like 2 feet long, a very small V that serves as a 50 megahertz dipole that is not sold as a part of the package, but an addition to the package. So you need to ask DX Canada using exact wording. The wording is rotatable 730 volts HFV dipole, 2000 watts PEP, designed for hams from Japan, and the word DX Canada. And you recharge now $799.99 of Canadian dollars plus tax, and plus another, I believe, 25% of the tax, plus the higher shipping and handling that is recently imposed by President Trump. Well, you voted for it, so you've got it, so be happy to pay for it. God bless America. This picture of the antenna, okay, so actually you have another option. You may buy the antenna from Canada. You're going to have all of the bands without 80 meter and 1.6. But you're going to have the extension of 6 meter, and you can buy it from Italy for 60.35 euro. That is now yielded over over the dollar 6.3%, approximately, due to the American new tariffs plus new President Trump tax on goods. So that can be adding another 60% to the price, as its shipping and handling may be much higher by now. But the good thing is that altogether may come to little less than buying it in one piece from Canada, so you may save around $150 on it. In any way, you are buying a product made in China, where Canada and Europe are only resellers for the parts of it. If somebody really wants to risk, there is another source, and this is not the Alibaba, there is AliExpress, and you may even pay for that antenna $379 American dollars, but I don't know if it's worth to try. So is that antenna good? Well, yes, it is very good. It is very according to the manufacturer. All antennas are the best, especially as they love us and our new tariffs so much. But Dr. Roy may have a different opinion, and I wouldn't be surprised if his opinion is not necessarily the one.
Make it okay.
Well, you stop as well.
Anyway, not that impressed. It's an inverted V with traps and capacitive hats. It might be good. It might not be good. I don't have it. I never used it. I don't trust any possible review that's written on it. So it's an interesting model. It's certainly, the marketing is absurd. It's not a high-efficiency antenna. It's got traps in it, and traps are not efficient. So there's a lot of marketing hyperbole. But, you know, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. If you want to, spend the money. If you don't.
Thank you very much. Dr. Ray, I thought you're going to exactly say that what you said, and it has its merit. I think you're right, but I made it semi-humoristic, satiristic comment on that antenna, but the antenna is really one of its kind. That what I don't like about the antenna is that if you look just at 6 meters, you have a dipole that is in V shape, and a small addition to that big dipole. So what you think? Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Well, it seems to be a little bit of a hodgepodge. They probably felt that it would be ridiculously inefficient if they slapped another trap on the main inverted V to operate on 6 meters, and it didn't really require that much of additional metal to make a separate one. So it strikes me as a wee bit of a kludge. It might be a wonderful antenna. Again, I don't know. I haven't had any experience with it, and I don't know of anyone that I trust that has had any experience. So it may be wonderful, it may be terrible, I don't know.
Yeah, it might be wonderful, it might be terrible. I assume it would be more terrible than it's wonderful. What do you think about it?
Well, again, I don't like to make guesses based on no facts whatsoever. I practically have negligible facts on this antenna. Again, I don't particularly like multi-trap antennas. They tend to require maintenance, and they are not high efficiency. So, you know, already you got a company that's promoting it as something that it's physically unlikely to be. So if they don't trust the company that makes it, that's not a good sign for the product.
Okay, the next one. Thank you very much for the Dr. Ray. Can you connect two attenuators 50 ohms in series to have 50 ohms in output? So I sent to Dr. Ray two pictures of bird. Well, bird is a bird. Okay, so it's not something that we can talk about. So bird 100 AMFN, 10 dB, 100 watts. The first model differs from the other one, that the first model has in and out from the front, and the other one, which is bird 100 SA MFN, is also 100 watts, 10 dB attenuator, but this one has the input from one side and the output of the other side, and it looks like a coaxial a resistor inside. So question one. So we have a purely resistive resistor with a heat sink that can, but doesn't have to serve as a load, or never serves as a load. True or false? What would be the correct answer, Dr. Ray?
I would assume it has to be a partial load because, again, we're banging our heads against conservation of energy. If you're attenuating the signal, that energy's got to go somewhere, and most likely it's going to go to waste heat in the form of a resistive load.
Okay, so I take it as partial. Question two. When 50-ohm output of a transmitter is connected to 50-ohm out attenuator having its output connected to an antenna, 50-ohm, is this antenna connected actually to 50-ohm or 112-ohm impedance? That's right.
If it's built correctly, 50-ohms.
Okay, now that's the question third. When 50-ohm output of transmitter is connected to 50-ohm attenuator, that is connected to yet another 50-ohm attenuator in series, an output of the second attenuator is connected to the antenna 50-ohm. Is that antenna connected actually to 50-ohm, 100-ohm, or 200-ohm impedance?
If it's built correctly, 50-ohms. Attenuators shouldn't introduce impedance mismatches.
Okay. And question four. When 50 ohm output of transmitter is connected to 50 ohm load, is it the same as transmitter connected to 50 ohm attenuator? Back to you.
No, because it has an output, so it's not this identical. One is a inline device, and the other one is a terminal load.
So before I comment your answers, there is a question number five. How step attenuator works?
Well, I mean, that's kind of difficult to do again on the radio because it really requires some illustrations.